This is an interview with Admiral John A. Charles in Victoria on the 10th of January, 1983. Well, John, we better start before we die laughing at our reminiscences. We've discussed the scope of what we're going to cover, and it's enough for now to know that this morning we're going to start at the beginning, and so thank you very much for coming this morning. And we'll start, I suppose, with RMC. What was it that caused you to go to the Royal Military College, and where were you at school before RMC?
I was born and went to school in Rollo, Saskatchewan, small town.
Is that R-O-L-O?
R-O-U-L-E-A-U, Rollo, but it was And the small town in the prairies. During the Depression, there was not much future as far as one could see, and money was certainly scarce. My father ran the Rollo Motor and Electric Company, which really repaired anything that moved, and indeed gave me considerable apprenticeship in the repair and maintenance of machines and electric devices. This included power plants on farms, telephone system, tractors, wells. So I was really brought up in that sort of environment. I went to high school in Rollo. The only difference between myself and the rest of the children there is that my mother had taken me over to England in 1928, and I had been engrossed by the time we'd spent in the ship. I thoroughly enjoyed the transatlantic passage, and I was always interested in geography. I got my senior matric, that was grade 12, in Saskatchewan in 1933, and at that time, well, I guess it was summer 34, I was 16 years old. My father had a good friend called Colonel Mayhew, whose son had gone to RMC, and my father was determined I should go to university for an engineering degree. And Mayhew, whose son was there and lives here in Victoria now.
Logan?
No, not Logan. Decided that he would send me to RMC. And so I was interested in going into an engineering degree course. I knew nothing about the military at all. And so my father applied for me to enter RMC in the year 1934. And the letter came back that I was qualified, but they couldn't accept me that year, and I would be considered again next year, providing I continued my education. That summer I was playing lacrosse for the local town team, and Father Athol Murray, who ran Notre Dame College out of Wilcox, who I had known for quite some time, we were playing against his team, and I was a little bit better than usual that year, so he came up to me after the game and said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I have to continue my education." And he said, "Come and play lacrosse for me down at Notre Dame and take your second year arts." So I ended up the winter of 34-35 playing lacrosse, hockey, baseball, rugby, any other game you could play for Father Murray. Living.
Will you spell his name, please, for the table?
Oh, M-U-R-R-A-Y. Uh-huh. he was a well-known character. Books have been written about him. Films have been made about the hounds of Notre Dame. And I took my second year arts. That was English, French, history, geography, and geology.
Did your grade 12 take you into second year university?
Yeah. Well, that would be first year university in Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's right, called second year arts. That was what I got. And he was affiliated with the University of Ottawa. So somewhere on my file, I have a piece of paper there. I have my second year arts at the University of Ottawa. But most of the time we played games, like 7 days a week. However, I didn't have any, never have had any problem academic. And at the end of that summer, I remember we barnstormed all over Saskatchewan, Alberta, playing pickup games against local teams all over. We used to travel around in a truck and pass the hat. But so I was pretty physically fit at the end of this exercise. And I guess it was about end of July or August, I was notified I was accepted for RMC. And off I went and became a typical RMC cadet. The hazing in the college was extreme in those years.
Let me interject here a bit on RMC life. My father was on the staff at RMC in the later 30s, so I know RMC. Mm-hmm. I was a schoolboy at Regiopolis College of the Jesuits. So while you're talking about RMC, talk about as its fitness as a training establishment for professional military officers. Just bring that in. Who was with you in your year anyway?
Well, first of all, you were not in the regular force when you went to RMC. You paid to go there, a nominal sum.
Yes.
The syllabus for the college was basically of an engineering degree type, but it was not a degree-granting institution. But there was emphasis on the maths and the sciences in the academic curriculum. In addition, you took artillery, tactics, field engineering, you know, the basic elements of army training, and also riding. We had horses, aren't you? The people who were there in my class, there were 82 of us, I believe, in our class when we went in, and you usually lose a few in the first few weeks because of the arduous conditions, and they were physically very challenging, were people who, quite a number of private school boys, many whose fathers had been at RMC before, and I would the names run through. most of whom came from eastern Canada. I think there were three of us from Saskatchewan, a few from BC, but the majority were from Ontario, as I recall. And they had junior matric. So I was academically better off than most of them. I also was one of the younger cadets. I think O'Brien was the youngest one, because it had to do with the date of your birthday in the system. O'Brien was about 5 or 6 months younger than I was. He was also the shortest fellow too, I think, if I remember. The recruit system was such that the senior cadets, who were fourth year cadets, were responsible for imposing the disciplinary system. You ran everywhere. They were what they called benders, where the seniors would get you out and dressed in full pack and a rifle, you'd be running up and down stairs. So it was a...
That's benders, is it?
Yeah. Benders was what it was called. And the recruits took quite a beating in this system. The routine was that you got up at 6 o'clock, had a cold shower every morning. Incidentally, you also had to have your window open every night. Somebody went around and inspected you. So in the winter, with your window wide open, you usually had your greatcoat and your blankets, and I don't know what all on top. I guess the real emphasizing is that A, I was physically fit when I went there. B, at the end of the first year, I certainly was in pretty good physical shape. When I was also playing, I was on the track team in the fall, and I was on the hockey team in the winter. So I had sports on top of that, quite a bit of it.
A question that's going to be asked by somebody is yet unknown who's going to listen to this tape. There'll be psychologists and sociologists as interested in these tapes as historians. This is looked upon with horror today, this brutality. Put that in quotes, Alma, if you're typing this, the brutality. How do you regard this brutality as a training ground for young officers?
It obviously was carried too much to the extreme, and I think in future years it was eased off considerably. But similar sort of systems existed in West Point, very nearly as rigorous, and indeed in the English public schools.
Yes.
Later on when we went over and joined up with the pubs, which is what they called them, why, they had all been through some sort of similar hazing system, not to the same degree that we had, and it was carried to the extreme. But the intent in the system was to build the class spirit, and he certainly did that. Nobody was ever last. In other words, if you were on a race, there was always three people who came in as the last man.
Yeah.
And the idea was to help the other fellow. And this certainly came through loud and clear. Because if one made a mistake, you were all punished. Now, that's a bad system in a sense, but it certainly built a very strong class spirit. And indeed, it is very noticeable. We still are very closely tied to our classmates at college as a result of this. And it's the one thing that sticks in your mind more vividly than anything else.
Who was with you besides Scruffy that might have been Navy?
Well,
the two Caldwells were ahead of you, weren't they?
Yes, Jack had graduated, and
Frank
was in our senior's term, but he, of course, had gone into the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And just to explain that, the system was such that you did not have to join the regular force. In fact, there weren't enough billets in the regular forces to take all of them. Graduates from RMC, but you were required to join the militia or the reserves, and you could opt for whichever one you wanted to take. There was in the Navy, they took 10 out of our class, and 10 of us went down in the summer of 1936 to do naval training in Halifax. There were numbers that went and did Air Force training, and the rest of the people went and did Army militia training. And you were expected to continue this after you had graduated from RMC. And in fact, that is the way the system worked. But of course, our class, which graduated in 1939, they literally all went straight into the services and right up until the college reopened. That was the system. I applied to go into the naval training because I had this sort of background interest in seagoing and geography, and I didn't particularly want to go to Petawawa for the summer. We'd been up there anyway for it's a hole full of sand and flies.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that was the main reason why I went down or applied to be a naval reserve trainee that for summer. And we were then made temporary cadets, Royal Canadian Naval Volunteer Reserves, and we were paid for that, a small sum. I think it was something like a dollar a day or something. I can't remember the exact fee. The 10 of us, and this included O'Brien and Panner Brock, Zach Wood, Avery Stairs, and
S-T-A-I-R-S?
Yeah,
I know him.
Mickey Morrissey, Bob Bennett, and I'm sorry, I can't remember all the names without looking at a picture.
No, they can be found.
Yeah. And we went down to Halifax, and the first summer you spent ashore in Halifax, The second summer, you went down and you were a midshipman and went to see him to stores. Bill Lattimore was one term ahead of us, and that summer, his group were at sea. Kirkpatrick, and, you know. So, when we arrived in Halifax, we were accommodated in the lower floor of Admiralty House, which is really a basement underneath the back veranda. And we were first introduced to hammocks. We slung hammocks across pipes that were in this thing. And we started learning a new language. You know, first of all, we had to learn not just how to stomp our feet. We did not have naval uniforms. We wore our RMC uniforms. For our normal working day, we wore RMC khaki fatigues, which was a sensible rig, incidentally, in Halifax. It was hot as hell that summer.
Yes.
The syllabus consisted of, first of all, seamanship, which was instruction, and a certain amount of boat pulling down there and off a jetty. Of course, Stadacona, as you know, recall it, was not there then.
It was down in the dockyard, yeah.
Yeah, it was down in the dockyard, and we used to walk down the garden from Admiralty House down to the dockyard. The syllabus was, as I say, boat seamanship, boat work, a certain amount of naval drill, although we were all pretty capable of that, and rifle drill. But, of course, our introduction to 6-inch naval gunnery, and that sticks in my mind quite vividly, because they had a 6-inch loader in that damn gunnery school down there back of the headquarters building, and the two GIs, one was Chief Petty Officer Prisk, and I can't remember that, but...
Green was there? Chief Petty Officer Green?
No,
Chief Petty Officer Bingham?
Bingham, that's it, Bingham. These guys were just as brutal. If there was any skylarking at all, well, you ended up on that 6-inch loaded.
Yeah. Well, I did my time under Bingham and Priscom Green.
Yeah, well, they were just the same. Yeah. And so we spent quite a bit of time slinging those, 6-inch brick weight, about 50 pounds, 40, 50 pounds.
Who was OIC of the gunnery school?
I can't.
Pullen was there in 39.
No, I don't know if it exists. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But our Snotty's nurse was Bill Holmes. He was the left-hand commander at that time. And so we really didn't have much association with, we lived fairly well within our own. We wore red tunics for Sunday parade. We enjoyed the social life in Halifax. They were very good to us, and it lasts for ever after. I found people most amenable, and we got along fine.
You talk about W.B.L. Holmes as the Snotty's nurse in 39?
Well, I suppose Billy was a...
You had dinner with him at the Union Club the other night, and I know it's a different Billy Holmes. But Billy Holmes
was a fellow. He was a very naval fellow, and he was trying to change us from soldiers to sailors, and in a 2-month period was pretty difficult.
Yeah.
The thing I remember particularly about this was that this was the time of the jitterbug, and we were at a reception or something up in the main floor of Admiralty House, and the report came back at the end of the summer that this was to RMC, Baldy Agnew was a commandant of RMC, the RMC cadets proceeded to turn the Admiralty House into a nightclub, and so I picked up the name of Floor Show as a result of that exercise.
What, Floor Show Charles?
Yeah.
I've never heard a nickname for you. It's Floor Show, is it? Well, good.
Well, that was what I was known as the RMC and Scruff and Frew. Freddie Frew.
Freddie Frew,
Who we didn't meet until we became naval cadet.
No.
However, it was really quite a good introduction to the Navy, in the sense that we learned about boats and we learned the naval language, and seamanship I delighted in because it was a practical sort of thing, and all my experience on the prairies was in the same vein. So I had no difficulty with the academics or anything.
I met Pat Budge as a gunner in 39. Was he there?
I do not remember Pat then. I remember Pat when he was a gunner in Assiniboine.
We'll come to him later.
We come to him later. And I cannot remember our instructors in the various navigation seamanship, other than Kristen Finnick. So, other than I remember, I had a very good summer, and I enjoyed my time at sea. There were very few ships there. Champlain and Vancouver, and one of the newer ones, you know, Saguenay or Skeena. But there wasn't much of a navy, and there weren't...
The minesweepers, I guess, the coal-burning minesweepers. Gaspé and Fundy, I think.
And I remember a French sort of sloop came in there, Ville d'Est.
Would you spell it for the tape?
Ville, like...
Ville,
D'Est, D, possibly I-S-T-E. And we certainly were down on board, and this was one of the social events we had on board a ship. We didn't see much of the ships, and indeed we didn't have much to do with naval personnel per se, other than our instructors.
Did you form any opinion about the French Navy from that brief visit?
I suppose in the expression we use at RMC, it was very casual, which meant slap happy sort of thing. And so we weren't terribly impressed with the efficiency, but then it was a casual sort of slap happy organization. I think that was our
compared to our ship.
Yeah, and the sailors weren't particularly impressive, you know, lounging about and that sort of thing. At the end of the summer training, we were allowed to go home on leave, and so I went back to my parents' home in Rolo. And then we went back to RMC in the fall. By this time we were third classmen, and all the recruiting was over. And so the third classmen were really starting in a real academic year, because you could argue that the first academic year at RMC was basically a senior matric year, which really was worth. And then we started into engineering training, you know, geometrical drawing and engineering, higher grade of physics, I'm not sure. And I enjoyed the third class year a lot. I had no problem academically. I think it was third or fourth in the class. And I enjoyed artillery. When we finished the third year, O'Brien was first and I was second in artillery. The commandant at that time was Agnew, and he was an artillery officer. Brownfield was an artillery officer.
What was Brownfield?
No, the commandant was Matthews. Brownfield was a major, and Agnew was a major, and they were both artillery officers. The commandant was Matthews. And they both were very keen that we would join the artillery. As it so happened, when we came to join the Navy, they were disappointed we left. Now, the question of joining the Navy arose, and I cannot remember the exact day. It was in the spring of 1937. And it was Mingy, I believe, who came down and interviewed any cadets who wanted to join the Navy. And we were called over about 10 o'clock in the morning to meet this great man, who, as I remember, was a commander at the time.
Yes.
And he asked us whether we wanted to join the Navy, and said that if we did, we would be sent over to the RM to join as a cadet and then become a midshipman.
Did he give a pitch for the Navy at all?
Not particularly. He just explained in a reasonable way what the process would be if we did. And then he said, now, how would you like to decide? I'll give you 15 minutes, which was the long break there. You know, we went and had milk and cocoa come down. So O'Brien and I went off, and we had a glass of milk and our cookies were coming out. And we flipped a coin and came down there. And we went and said, we'll join the Navy. And that was all that happened. And at this stage, it must have been cranked into the system, because they said Well, you don't have to do summer training this year. This was in the summer of 37, because you're going over the Orient. So they sent us off on leave after we finished our third class year. So we said goodbye to our friends. And somewhere along the line, I got a telegram telling me I was to report in Montreal in August of 1937 for passage to the UK. So I went a bit early. I was there. O'Brien lived in Montreal.
Yeah.
And I stayed with O'Brien. We had a little week to do in Montreal. And I think it was the 20th of August. Yeah, that's right. August the 20th. We went down to join SS Ausonia, which was to take us to
I see her picture there.
Yeah, that's right. To take us to the UK. And we knew that we're...
There's her sister ship, the Alania, where I served as a midshipman.
As an AMC.
Yeah.
And we knew there were other cadets coming, but we didn't know any of them. So we got there a bit early, and we stood at the top of the brow, trying to pick out which of these characters would be prospective naval cadets. And Peter Cassette came down, and became, his sister, yes, was a girlfriend of one of our third classmates at RMC. Anyway, so Peter was the first one we picked out of the system, and he was a delightful fellow. And Peter was the one who'd had, because his father was in the Navy, knew quite a bit about the Navy. So he was a delightful person. Freddie Frew came from Lakefield. He was quite young. And we, in general, were 2 years older than our contemporaries in the system because of RMC.
Yes.
Frew was born in 1920. He was just 2 years older than younger than I was. And Frew didn't smoke, didn't drink, and come straight from Lakefield, and was a good athlete all around, and a delightful fellow. So Frew joined our team, and then the rest of the team was Tony Eden, who came from Moose Jaw, who was a nephew of Anthony Eden. More unlike him you couldn't imagine, but but full of vim and vigor. The executive cadets were the two of us, Frewer, Tony Eden, Jake McDowell, Timmy Porter, and Bob Timbrell, both of whom had been to Conway, so they knew about the Navy.
Yes.
They had just come home for summer, and they were joining just the same as the RN people from Conway. A French-Canadian called Clément Savard, and Clem spoke very little English indeed. He could say hello and goodbye, and that was about it. Clem was had a real problem in this system, as you can imagine. Dudley Elcock, and I guess that was our team. Oh, and Jake McDowell.
Yeah.
And Jake came from Ottawa.
Yeah.
And was a bit, he was a big fleshy fellow and not in particularly good physical shape, and a member of the awkward squad from the beginning.
Member of the awkward squad,
awkward squad. So we joined this good ship, and we became pretty good friends all around, really. And spent 9 days crossing the Atlantic and the Oceania. And then we reported to Canada House in Trafalgar Square. And what was the name of the fellow? Anyway, who was our sort of Massey, I guess, was the High Commissioner, and Ritchie, I think, was the sort of second fellow in the thing. But this delightful fellow looked after us. There weren't very many on the staff, maybe four or five. He found us accommodation down in Kensington, in Manson Place, I guess. An old fellow who took in bed and breakfast guys.
Ritchie, did he go on to do great things?
Yeah, well, he wrote it. Well, he's the fellow.
Yeah, the Indiscretions of a Diplomat.
Yeah,
a
diary.
That Ritchie. Yeah.
And so we were given 10 days. On the first day, we had to go down to Guise and get measured for our uniform. And then we and London was a bit of a lonely place for people who didn't know anybody, and so we wandered around, seeing the sights and doing the things, although I had been around them all before. And I had relatives who lived down on Duke's Peak. We met a fellow who was a member of the British Empire Society. And he took us down to, and we became members of the British Empire Society, which had a club down on Northumberland Street. And that gave us a slight introduction to some contemporary theater. But we really didn't know London at that time, and other than we were a bunch of cadets wandering around, found it interesting, it didn't really stick with us particularly. At the end of the period, and I'm trying to fix it, I can't remember the exact date, it was early in September anyway, we were told to report into Guise, and Guise, we got into our uniforms, naval cadet uniform, took off all our civilian clothes, put them in a black box there in Guise, and the Guise people sent reports to Zip, and we said, what about all the rest of our uniform? They said, oh, no problem. So we went down and joined HMS Erebus. The interesting thing about the uniform was that when we got down there, we had a chest of drawers, and all the uniforms were there, the shirts, the socks, the underwear, everything in the drawers, in the chest. In the chest it was assigned to us, all labeled with our names. The service was superb.
Yes.
Incidentally, we had to pay for our uniforms. These weren't gratuitous.
No.
We had a bill at Guise, and I've had a bill at Guise ever since, I suppose. But the service was good, particularly for people coming from abroad. And so we went down to join this ship, Erebus. Now I'll try and explain. It was a World War I monitor. And it still had its 2 15-inch guns. They had built a small wooden gymnasium on the forecastle, which incidentally they took off, and the ship became active during World War II.
Yes.
It was strung between a pair of buoys just off the pierhead there on Whale Island, between Whale Island and the Portsmouth dockyard. They had, the cadets slept on the main mess deck in hammocks. So we were back to sleeping in hammocks and lashing up in stove. And unfortunately, we'd been through that exercise, so we at least knew how to do that, which was more than our other naval cadets who had never been exposed to this before. Our contemporaries were RN cadets who were the public school entry. They were people who came from public schools in the UK, and this also included people from Conway, Worcester, Pangbourne, in other words, the merchant ship training schools in England. We had, I think, three or four people from the Indian Navy. We did not have any Australians, and nominal list. Now, most of these public school cadets had the sort of disciplinary training. Usually they had COTC or some sort of military training in the schools they'd been at. So they weren't cold to the sort of disciplinary training. Whereas people like Jake McDowell and Freddie Prue were fairly... we had two Indian Navy people, Jackson and Curtis, who were English, not Indians. In fact, the next term we did have Indians, Indian Navy people who were Indians.
Yeah.
The first two Indian Navy people were not, they were Anglo-Indians?
Well,
were...
you apply, now, I think I got this straight. In the RN, you applied to join the RN, and they wrote exams. And so there was a sort of an academic selection system. And people who were down at the bottom of the list, who were not acceptable to the RN, could be accepted as RIN cadets. Now, there were also people who actually did apply to go in the RIN. And although we never had Australians, there were also, you know, the system catered for all the people of the Commonwealth, the Australians, the New Zealanders. They all joined up the same thing.
Excuse me, that has extraordinary connotations.
Well,
if you're not good enough for the RN, even though you're Brit born,
mm-hmm.
you're put down for the RIN. Is that?
That's my understanding of the way the system worked.
We have checked.
And indeed, to a certain extent, for example, at RMC there were not enough vacancies for people to go into the Canadian Army.
Yeah.
And so there were a number of people out here, Tony McLaughlin, Mickey McLaughlin, quite a number of people who went into the Indian Army from RMC. Equally well, of course, there were people who went into the Royal Engineers, Harry Boswell, Donnie McLeod, and there were... Brian, who was out at Royal Roads the other day, he went into the Trinidad Police.
Who's that?
A fellow called Brian, Jack Brian. He was...
B-R-Y-A-N. Yeah.
He was up at Tacoma. Huh. But when he left RMC, he went into the Trinidad Police. So there were vacancies in various parts of the MPOC, and the graduates from RMC could apply to go into these things. Now, sometimes... they did it because they wanted adventure, and the Indian Army was the only place that was any fighting at those days, which was up on the Northwest Frontier.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went for that sort of reason. You'd have to find out exactly why people went into these various things, but they did.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a number of people went into the Imperial Forces.
Yes.
As I say, Harry Baldwin. I'm sorry I got off the Navy, but I'm just explaining how this...
No, this is all good stuff.
The point really was that the British had a system which they were casting everybody into the same mold.
Yes.
Some were moldier than others, but, you know. But it did introduce a common doctrine throughout the system. You didn't have to look at the books. And it meant that you could take a Canadian destroyer, an Australian destroyer, a British destroyer, none who have ever met before, put them together, and they would operate together because everybody had the same, you knew that people thought the same way and brought up on the same system. So it had tremendous advantages during the war. There's no question about it. And we were all accepted. You look at the naval seniority list, but on the RN seniority list, there they were, all listed. The Australians, the New Zealanders, the Canadians, the Brits, the Indians, the Malaysians. And they were all listed on the seniority list. And that was it. And you were just acceptable in any one of those navies. You had power of command and punishment and everything else, just the same as your contemporaries in the other services. And you could flip from one to the other, just like that. So, in hindsight, there was a tremendous amount of merit in what they were doing.
And Britannia ruled the waves, and the empire was worldwide, and that was the system.
That was the system.
And it fitted the requirements of those years.
Yeah, and it worked.
And it worked.
And in some ways, I suppose in later time, I'll explain to my closer contact with the Americans, which was started in 1944, and the problems of trying to get American and British white ensign ships to operate together was a major problem because you had completely different doctrines and system of punishment and things like that. So, in a sense, this system was very useful and effective when it was required. Now, as far as the academic curriculum went in this
Erebus,
which was only a short period of time from September till December of 1937, we took the usual seamanship boat work. We were between boys, but we used to practice slipping cutters not underway. We did naval drill on the Whale Island parade ground. And again, it was back to the problem of not learning how to stomp your feet. But other than that, we were miles ahead of our contemporaries. We were in tossing a rifle around for 2 years. We had navigation, we had engineering, which was basically steam propulsion, electric power, and this, I know a lot about electricity, but of course in England they use different terms, like valves instead of tubes, and so there was a certain amount of learning another language. Well, you have to learn a new naval language, but also in the academic thing, there was quite a difference between the way they taught electricity and physics and engineering from the way we had been taught in a North American context. But again, O'Brien and I had no problems with the academic system at all. Our daily life consisted of being turned out of our hammocks with wakey wakey, lash and stow at about a quarter to six in the morning, and then as cadets, and we were the ship's company and yes. thing, there was scrub out, you know, and we were detailed off for various duties. One day you'd be scrubbing out the mess deck, and I must say on the mess deck we slept there and the tables were down below, in other words we ate in the same place as we slept. And then you were up on the upper deck scrubbing the quarter deck, and on Saturday morning you were holy stoning the quarter deck, you know, down on your knees with those sandstones, scrub forward, scrub aft, and guys going along the buses. And at 7 o'clock was shave and breakfast kick, and at 8 o'clock was hand fall in, and that was usually when the instruction started, which was various forms. Always in the guy would get you out there at 8 o'clock up on the forecastle, the PTI, and give you a physical dirt for about 15-20 minutes. It was colors in the winter, that was. Colors was at 9 o'clock. And so you had a guard. Different people were detailed off to take charge of the guard and do your thing at raising the ensign. Our leave, we were allowed leave on Saturday and Sunday, and it expired at 7 o'clock, which we, as RMC cadets, we found not too arduous, but we were fairly mature, and therefore I thought that was a bit much. As I say, we were older than most of our contemporaries. We really didn't. We used to go down to the GOAT in that damn hotel out at the end there. We did a tour of the Victory. We did the usual
of course
sightseeing kicks, but. We lived fairly well within our own in that thing. We made a lot of good friends with our contemporaries. We were accepted and in this group without any hesitation at all. I suppose the odd one had this peculiar sort of colonial complex, but he was rapidly disabused of that. A, we were in better physical shape than most of them. B, we were older, and C, academically, we had no problem.
But there was this attitude towards the colonials, and...
There were some.
But the colonials fought it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the story of Harry de Wolfe. The cry in his gun room once was, often used to be, out with the colonials.
Yeah.
And he said, we were very seldom, all of us, thrown out.
Yeah, well, it didn't take long to establish that status. So... that rapidly disappeared if there was any after.
Was there a sub of the gun room?
Not in Erebus, nor indeed in the cadet traineeship. The first time we ran into the sub of the gun room was when we were midship.
So and you're, I can you're Snotty's nurse, or you're not Snotty's?
Well, there was no Snotty's nurse per se in the cadet traineeship. We were, you know, we had a station card, we were allocated a part of ship and a quarter starboard.
Yeah, you were the hands.
Yeah, we were the hands. And all the people in the ship were involved in nothing but training cadets. So that's about all I can remember of that cadet system.
That's a good picture. Where did you go from Erebus?
Well, the next part of the drill, we were given Christmas leave, and then after Christmas we were posted to Vindictive, which was a seagoing cadet training ship.
Yeah.
And when we joined Vindictive, there
were
two...
What year are we now? We're in
1938.
Yeah.
January 38. In Vindictive, there was the term that had been... You did two terms in Vindictive. It was the term that had been there before, so they were senior cadets, and we went to Vindictive as junior cadets. Again, we were the ship's company,
yeah.
Per se. We were joined in our group, of this group of pubs, with the people from Dartmouth.
Yeah.
And so all together in our term, there were about 100 cadets, which included the pubs and the darts. The darts were people who had been to Dartmouth for 3 years, and so they hadn't been exposed to naval training, and in general they were younger than the pup. They were also, of course, rather superior in their attitude, which is fair enough, I think. But that gradually worked out, you know, in the long run. We ended up being a cadet is a cadet is a cadet, no matter where the hell you came from or what was the system. And we sailed from Sheerness early in January for what was called the spring cruise. And the spring cruise, of course, meant going where the weather was good. So our first stop after Sheerness was Tortola in the Virgin Islands. And we were doing a cruise on the West Indian Islands. We, again, were slinging in hammocks, both in the mess decks and in the studies. In the training ship, they had built a whole row of studies up amidships, aft of the funnel. And so they were used as, we slept in them at night, and in the daytime they were used as studies, and the mess deck was the same arrangement. You slept, I remember I was in a study, I was sleeping in a study, but there were others also sleeping on the mess deck. And that's where you ate, one big open space. And the mess tables came down, and you could open it up for church or films.
Yeah.
Flicks, is it called?
Flicks, yes.
Flicks. There was a little bit bigger ship's company in Vindictive, in that the engine room department was proper. RN sailors, and there were more instructors, in other words, because of the increased number of cadets, and also because of the large amount of boat work we did. We were carrying 6 cutters and 6 whalers and 8 or 10 dinghies. So one thing we did in that damn training ship was sea boat drill every day, all boats away. The system was such that the senior cadets were detailed off for the senior jobs. In other words, the coxswain of the boats, the fellow in charge of the slipping, boat lowering.
Yeah.
There was the navigator's tankie, the engineer officer's tankie, the commander's tankie.
Captain's doggy.
Yeah, captain's doggy, that sort of thing. So the senior cadets all got detailed off for these jobs, and the junior cadets were working hands. And, of course, you had, in addition, these academics, navigation, seamanship, electric, and engineering. And we had a normal academic day, except that usually there were sea boats in the morning and sea boats in the dog watch. And they ignore all the boats and off you go. Occasionally the weather was too rough, but normally that's what we did. When we sailed from Sheerness down the channel, it was rough as hell. It really was blowing hard, and this was a reintroduction to seagoing life. I did not get seasick, but a great number of the cadets did, for sure they did.
Of course.
And it was a pretty unpleasant 3 or 4 day's introduction to seagoing life in a warship. But after that, the weather cleaned up, and we went to Tortola to clean up the ship. I don't know. Now, the crew... I specifically remember going, we were anchored off Tortola in the British Virgin Islands, and the ship was pretty badly rusted, and since we were going with cruise on it, the first thing to do was paint ship, which is normally what you do when you go to the West Indies anyway.
Yeah.
And, of course, who was going to paint the ship but the cadets? And this is my first introduction to sharks. The garbage from the ship attracted the sharks. And originally we were hijacking all these stages, you know, falling off the stages into the water until these damn sharks appeared. And the, I remember the, we were up painting on the fourth side of the forecastle, and he lowered the stage down. We were skylarking, you know, not really getting on with painting. It was a lovely Caribbean day. And he said, "Get on, lay a move, or I'll let go your end." So we had these shreddy POs up below, quite prepared to dump you in the water.
With the shark.
Yeah, so got an incentive to get on with the painting. Again, our leave expired, but there was nothing to do, you know.
I know Tortola.
And I'll tell you, in 1938...
I took my ship in there for the same reason. There's nothing to do there except paint ship.
Yeah. It was a pretty dire community in 1938, for sure. But we went and swam on the beaches and used to go and have tea with a fellow who retired there on Beef Island, and we had bananas and that sort of thing. I think we were there about a week. And then we went off on our cruise, and I don't know whether I can particularly describe it, but I think the next stop in the thing was... We went to San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And, the slums in Puerto Rico were horrific. I'd never seen in life. But there were Americans there, too, and I remember there was one of those, the sailors, not the cadets, sailors got in a fight with Americans in it was called the Ron Rico Bar, and it was straight out of a movie. You know, people swinging from chandeliers.
Yeah.
I didn't believe things like that happened, but we used to wear blazers ashore, blazers and gray bags, and a gray hat. Always had to wear a hat.
Yeah.
A gray fell hat.
Boomer Hope used to say, a gentleman would sooner go ashore without his trousers than without his hat.
Yeah, well, that's we either had pork pies or the issued gray felt hat. And we had quite good fun in Puerto Rico. The Americans had laid on parties, receptions, and that kind of thing. And it was an interesting place.
That would be your first meeting with the USN.
Yeah, that's right. As I say, this fight was the thing that stuck in my mind.
What was your opinion... As a cadet of the... Now, after your opinion of the French Navy, what was your opinion of the USN, as you remember it?
Well, A, they were quite different. B, they were rather like you've seen in all those movies, you know, before the war. They were sailors ashore. The junior officers were very much like us.
They'd be Annapolis boys, you see.
Yeah, that's right. Finally, I didn't mention, when I was at RMC... On the hockey team.
Of course, the hockey, yes.
I went down with the team to West Point. So that was my first introduction to West Point.
Yeah.
And I have a vivid recollection of that one, was that the West Point, they had a hotel in West Point. I think it was called the Thayer Hotel.
T-H-A-Y-E-R.
Yeah. And they invited the guests, their mothers and their girlfriends, up to this, to stay in this hotel for the... the ball and all that. And on the hockey team, I think there were about 18 or 20 of us that had gone down on the team. And there were, at that time, about 1,200 cadets, West Point cadets. Mm-hmm. And their leave expired at midnight. And so we suddenly found ourselves with masses of females.
And your leave?
That was the only place our leave didn't expire.
Oh.
So I have vivid memories of our night after the ball and...
Well, that's an ideal situation. You've got until midnight to choose your partner,
yeah.
And then they all go back.
Yeah.
What a wonderful situation.
And, of course, the other thing we used to do was change uniforms. The first year we went to West Point, and the second year the pointers came to us.
Yes.
So we would end up in tar buckets, and I think I still got some of those West Point uniforms.
What's tar bucket?
Well, the West Point cadet, in their dress uniform, they had a black flat thing with a plume up
there,
and that was called a tar bucket.
Tar bucket.
And we had pill boxes, so they were always easy. All right, but anyway, the junior officers in the U.S. Air at that time, in my mind, were very similar to the RMC cadets.
Yeah.
And they'd been through a rigorous sort of training system, too, and so I couldn't find, and since we spoke really the same way, and we were frequently called Yanks because of our, by the Brits, because of our voices, we found that we were very compatible, comparable, and they were very knowledgeable people too. They'd been through their 4 years at Annapolis. They were older than we were. Well, we were cadets anyway, and they were ensigns in the ships.
Yes.
So there was a difference in age.
You can't fault the USN on schooling, can you, ever?
No, they were always, or have, well, except, of course, I can get into an argument about that later on when I was in Royal Roads and got involved in comparing.
Well, we'll save it for then. But
differences. So that was really all I remember much about the USN at that time. Then we set off from San Juan, and we went to Antigua, and did the tour of English Nelson's Harbor.
Yeah.
And there were the usual sort of cocktail parties which we attended, which were pretty popular with the cadets, because it was the only damn break from the system. And we went to Grenada, which I thought was a delightful island, and by far the best of all the islands. And it was getting fairly warm by that time. And we went to Barbados, and that was very hospitable. We thoroughly enjoyed that. It was the usual tours and sailing and things. And then we headed east and went to Madeira, which was a fascinating place in those years. And the thing I remember about that was in Madeira they had these wineries, which made Madeira port. And O'Brien and Fuhr and I ended up in one of these wineries, and there were rows and rows of kegs with dates on them. And the idea was, and the floor was all covered in sawdust. And you went along and sampled out of one, and you were supposed to spit it out. Well, that was the normal. The difference was that we weren't spitting it out. So our leave expired at 7 o'clock, and we missed the 7 o'clock boat.
That's right.
I think that was the first time I was in the Navy. I really had drank more than I was capable of holding. I forget how we got back to the ship, but obviously in a bumboat somehow. But I know our leave was stopped, and we were also in pack drill, and that meant that every afternoon in the dog watch, and I think this lasted for 10 days, we had to put on the usual pack loaded with something like 15 or 20 pounds and a rifle and double around the on top of the studies, they had a deck there. And so that was called number 11 in those days.
Mm-hmm.
It was very similar to the stuff that we've been getting at RMC, but nevertheless, doing this at sea was something rather unusual. And that was the punishment that we detailed out for breaking the leave of the cadet. From Madeira, we went to Jib.
Where are we going now? Where is Madeira?
Came straight across, really, and Madeira's
there we are, Madeira.
Yeah. The only thing is,
who owned Madeira? What country owned Madeira?
Portugal. And we ended up with a whole bunch of canaries. The thing you could get from Madeira was canaries. And here you can see a picture of that. We all bought these damn canaries, and then they had a judge contest, which canary looked the best and which canary sang the best.
Here you can see the commander of the ship judging the cadets' canaries.
Is that your captain?
Yeah, that was Spooner. He was he went on to be captain of the Republic.
Spooner. Captain Spooner.
Yeah. At the end of that cruise, we ended up in Sheerness, and there was prize giving. Now, remember, we were junior terminus. Eh? The prize, the fellow who was giving prizes at the time was Lord Gort, the Army General. And I did quite well academically. I think it was top of the class. No, I wasn't top of the class.